Chapter 3. Send Mixed Signals. Once people are aware of your presence, and perhaps vaguely intrigued, you need to stir their interest before it settles on someone else. What is obvious and striking may attract their attention at first, but that attention is often short-lived. In the long run, ambiguity is much more potent. Most of us are much too obvious. Instead, be hard to figure out. Send mixed signals, both tough and tender, both spiritual and earthy, both innocent and cunning. A mix of qualities suggests depth, which fascinates even as it confuses. An elusive, enigmatic aura will make people want to know more, drawing them into your circle. Create such a power by hinting at something contradictory within you. Good and bad. In 1806, when Prussia and France were at war, Auguste, the handsome 24-year-old Prince of Prussia and nephew of Frederick the Great, was captured by Napoleon. Instead of locking him up, Napoleon allowed him to wander around French territory, keeping a close watch on him through spies. The prince was devoted to pleasure and spent his time moving from town to town, seducing young girls. In 1807, he decided to visit the Château de Coppée in Switzerland, where lived the great French writer Madame de Stael. Auguste was greeted by his hostess with as much ceremony as she could muster. After she had introduced him to her other guests, they all retired to a drawing room where they talked of Napoleon's war in Spain, the current Paris fashions, and so on. Suddenly, the door opened and another guest entered, a woman who had somehow stayed in her room during the hubbub of the prince's entrance. It was the 30-year-old Madame Récamier, Madame de Stael's closest friend. She introduced herself to the prince, then quickly retired to her bedroom. Auguste had known that Madame Récamier was at the chateau. In fact, he had heard many stories about this infamous woman, who, in the years after the French Revolution, was considered the most beautiful in France. Men had gone wild over her, particularly at balls when she would take off her evening wrap, revealing the diaphanous white dresses that she had made famous, and dance with such abandon. The painters Gerard and David had immortalized her face and fashions, and even her feet, considered the most beautiful anyone had ever seen. And she had broken the heart of Lucien Bonaparte, the Emperor Napoleon's brother. Auguste liked his girls younger than Madame Récamier, and he had come to the chateau to rest. But those few moments in which she had stolen the scene with her sudden entrance caught him off guard. She was as beautiful as people had said, but more striking than her beauty was that look of hers that seemed so sweet, indeed heavenly, with a hint of sadness in the eyes. The other guests continued their conversations, but Auguste could only think of Madame Récamier. Over dinner that evening, he watched her. She did not talk much and kept her eyes downward, but once or twice she looked up, directly at the prince. After dinner, the guests assembled in the gallery, and a harp was brought in. To the prince's delight, Madame Récamier began to play, singing a love song. And now, suddenly, she changed. There was a roguish look in her eye as she glanced at him. The angelic voice, the glances, the energy animating her face sent his mind reeling. He was confused. When the same thing happened the next night, the prince decided to extend his stay at the chateau. In the days that followed, the prince and Madame Récamier took walks together, rode out on the lake, and attended dances where he finally held her in his arms. They would talk late into the night, but nothing grew clear to him. She would seem so spiritual, so noble, and then there would be a touch of the hand, a sudden flirtatious remark. After 2 weeks at the chateau, the most eligible bachelor in Europe forgot all his libertine habits and proposed marriage to Madame Récamier. He would convert to Catholicism, her religion, and she would divorce her much older husband. She had told him her marriage had never been consummated, and so the Catholic Church could annul it. She would then come to live with him in Prussia. Madame promised to do as he wished. The prince hurried off to Prussia to seek the approval of his family, and Madame returned to Paris to secure the required annulment. Auguste flooded her with love letters and waited. Time passed. He felt he was going mad. Then, finally, a letter. She had changed her mind. Some months later, Madame Récamier sent Auguste a gift. Gérard's famous painting of her reclining on a sofa. The prince spent hours in front of it, trying to pierce the mystery behind her gaze. He had joined the company of her conquests, of men like the writer Benjamin Constant, who said of her, "She was my last love. For the rest of my life, I was like a tree struck by lightning." Interpretation. Madame Récamier's list of conquests became only more impressive as she grew older. There was Prince Metternich, the Duke of Wellington, the writers Constant and Chateaubriand. For all of these men, she was an obsession, which only increased in intensity when they were away from her. The source of her power was twofold. First, she had an angelic face which drew men to her. It appealed to paternal instincts, charming with its innocence. But then there was a second quality peeking through in the flirtatious looks, the wild dancing, the sudden gaiety. All these caught men off guard. Clearly, there was more to her than they had thought, an intriguing complexity. When alone, they would find themselves pondering these contradictions as if a poison were coursing through their blood. Madame Récamier was an enigma, a problem that had to be solved. Whatever it was that you wanted, whether a coquettish she-devil or an unattainable goddess, she could seem to be. She surely encouraged this illusion by keeping her men at a certain distance so they could never figure her out, and she was the queen of the calculated effect, like her surprise entrance at the Chateau de Coppet, which made her the center of attention, if only for a few seconds. The seductive process involves filling someone's mind with your image. Your innocence, or your beauty, or your flirtatiousness can attract their attention, but not their obsession. They will soon move on to the next striking image. To deepen their interest, you must hint at a complexity that cannot be grasped in a week or two. You are an elusive mystery, an irresistible lure, promising great pleasure if only it can be possessed. Once they begin to fantasize about you, they are on the brink of the slippery slope of seduction and will not be able to stop themselves from sliding down. Artificial and natural. The big Broadway hit of 1881 was Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta, Patience, a satire on the bohemian world of aesthetes and dandies that had become so fashionable in London. To cash in on this vogue, the operetta's promoters decided to invite one of England's most infamous aesthetes to America for a lecture tour, Oscar Wilde. Only 27 at the time, Wilde was more famous for his public persona than for his small body of work. The American promoters were confident that their public would be fascinated by this man, whom they imagined as always walking around with a flower in his hand. But they did not expect it to last. He would do a few lectures, then the novelty would wear off, and they would ship him home. The money was good, and Wilde accepted. On his arrival in New York, a customs man asked him whether he had anything to declare. "I have nothing to declare," he replied, "except my genius." The invitations poured in. New York society was curious to meet this oddity. Women found Wilde enchanting, but the newspapers were less kind. The New York Times called him an aesthetic sham. Then, a week after his arrival, he gave his first lecture. The hall was packed. More than 1,000 people came, many of them just to see what he looked like. They were not disappointed. Wilde did not carry a flower and was taller than they had expected, but he had long, flowing hair and wore a green velvet suit and cravat, as well as knee breeches and silk stockings. Many in the audience were put off as they looked up at him from their seats. The combination of his large size and pretty attire were rather repulsive. Some people openly laughed. Others could not hide their unease. They expected to hate the man. Then he began to speak. The subject was the, quote, English Renaissance, the, quote, art for art's sake movement in late 19th century England. Wilde's voice proved hypnotic. He spoke in a kind of meter, mannered and artificial, and few really understood what he was saying, but the speech was so witty, and it flowed. His appearance was certainly strange, but overall, no New Yorker had ever seen or heard such an intriguing man, and the lecture was a huge success. Even the newspapers warmed up to it. In Boston, a few weeks later, some 60 Harvard boys had prepared an ambush. They would make fun of this effeminate poet by dressing in knee breeches, carrying flowers, and applauding far too loudly at his entrance. Wilde was not the least bit flustered. The audience laughed hysterically at his improvised comments, and when the boys heckled him, he kept his dignity, betraying no anger at all. Once again, the contrast between his manner and his physical appearance made him seem rather extraordinary. Many were deeply impressed, and Wilde was well on his way to becoming a sensation. The short lecture tour turned into a cross-country affair. In San Francisco, this visiting lecturer on art and aesthetics proved able to drink everyone under the table and play poker, which made him the hit of the season. On his way back from the West Coast, Wilde was to make stops in Colorado and was warned that if the pretty boy poet dared to show up in the mining town of Leadville, he would be hung from the highest tree. It was an invitation Wilde could not refuse. Arriving in Leadville, he ignored the hecklers and nasty looks. He toured the mines, drank and played cards, then lectured on Botticelli and Cellini in the saloons. Like everyone else, the miners fell under his spell, even naming a mine after him. One cowboy was heard to say, "That fellow is some art guy, but he can drink any of us under the table and afterwards carry us home two at a time." Interpretation. In a fable he improvised at dinner once, Oscar Wilde talked about some steel filings that had a sudden desire to visit a nearby magnet. As they talked to each other about this, they found themselves moving closer to the magnet without realizing how or why. Finally, they were swept in one mass to the magnet's side. Then the magnet smiled, for the steel filings had no doubt at all but that they were paying that visit of their own free will. Such was the effect that Wilde himself had on everyone around him. Wilde's attractiveness was more than just a byproduct of his character. It was quite calculated. An adorer of paradox, he consciously played up his own weirdness and ambiguity, the contrast between his mannered appearance and his witty, effortless performance. Naturally warm and spontaneous, he constructed an image that ran counter to his nature. People were repelled, confused, intrigued, and finally drawn to this man who seemed impossible to figure out. Paradox is seductive because it plays with meaning. We are secretly oppressed by the rationality in our lives, where everything is meant to mean something. Seduction, by contrast, thrives on ambiguity, on mixed signals, on anything that eludes interpretation. Most people are painfully obvious. If their character is showy, we may be momentarily attracted, but the attraction wears off. There's no depth, no contrary motion to pull us in. The key to both attracting and holding attention is to radiate mystery. And no one is naturally mysterious, at least not for long. Mystery is something you have to work at, a ploy on your part, and something that must be used early on in the seduction. Let one part of your character show so everyone notices it. In the example of Wilde, this was the mannered affectation conveyed by his clothes and poses, but also send out a mixed signal, some sign that you're not what you seem, a paradox. Don't worry if this underquality is a negative one, like danger, cruelty, or amorality. People will be drawn to the enigma anyway, and pure goodness is rarely seductive. Keys to Seduction. Nothing can proceed in seduction unless you can attract and hold your victim's attention, your physical presence becoming a haunting mental presence. It is actually quite easy to create that first stir, an alluring style of dress, a suggestive glance, something extreme about you. But what happens next? Our minds are barraged with images, not just from media, but from the disorder of daily life. And many of these images are quite striking. You become just one more thing screaming for attention. Your attractiveness will pass, unless you spark the more enduring kind of spell that makes people think of you in your absence. That means engaging their imaginations, making them think there is more to you than what they see. Once they start embellishing your image with their fantasies, they are hooked. This must, however, be done early on, before your targets know too much and their impressions of you are set. It should occur the moment they lay eyes on you. By sending mixed signals in that first encounter, you create a little surprise, a little tension. You seem to be one thing, innocent, brash, intellectual, witty, but you also throw them a glimpse of something else, devilish, shy, spontaneous, sad. Keep things subtle. If the second quality is too strong, you will seem schizophrenic. But make them wonder why you might be shy or sad underneath your brash intellectual wit, and you will have their attention. Give them an ambiguity that lets them see what they want to see. Capture their imagination with little voyeuristic glimpses into your dark soul. The Greek philosopher Socrates was one of history's greatest seducers. The young men who followed him as students were not just fascinated by his ideas, they fell in love with him. One such youth was Alcibiades, the notorious playboy who became a powerful political figure near the end of the 5th century BC. In Plato's Symposium, Alcibiades describes Socrates' seductive powers by comparing him to the little figures of Silenus that were made back then. In Greek myth, Silenus was quite ugly, but also a wise prophet. Accordingly, the statues of Silenus were hollow, and when you took them apart, you would find little figures of gods inside them, the inner truth and beauty under the unappealing exterior. And so for Alcibiades, it was the same with Socrates, who was so ugly as to be repellent, but whose face radiated inner beauty and contentment. The effect was confusing and attractive. Antiquity's other great seducer, Cleopatra, also sent out mixed signals. By all accounts, physically alluring, in voice, face, body, and manner, she also had a brilliantly active mind, which for many writers of the time made her seem somewhat masculine in spirit. These contrary qualities gave her complexity, and complexity gave her power. To capture and hold attention, you need to show attributes that go against your physical appearance, creating depth and mystery. If you have a sweet face and an innocent air, let out hints of something dark, even vaguely cruel in your character. It isn't advertised in your words, but in your manner. The actor Errol Flynn had a boyishly angelic face and a slight air of sadness. Beneath this outward appearance, however, women could sense an underlying cruelty, a criminal streak, an exciting kind of dangerousness. This play of contrary qualities attracted obsessive interest. The female equivalent is the type epitomized by Marilyn Monroe. She had the face and voice of a little girl, but something sexual and naughty emanated powerfully from her as well. Madame Récamier did it all with her eyes, the gaze of an angel, suddenly interrupted by something sensual and flirtatious. Playing with gender roles is a kind of intriguing paradox that has a long history in seduction. The greatest Don Juans have had a touch of prettiness and femininity, and the most attractive courtesans have had a masculine streak. The strategy, though, is only powerful when the underquality is merely hinted at. If the mix is too obvious or striking, it will seem bizarre or even threatening. The great 17th century French courtesan, Ninon de L'Enclos, was decidedly feminine in appearance, yet everyone who met her was struck by a touch of aggressiveness and independence in her, but just a touch. The late 19th century Italian novelist, Gabriele D'Annunzio, was certainly masculine in his approaches, but there was a gentleness, a consideration mixed in, and an interest in feminine finery. The combinations can be juggled every which way. Oscar Wilde was quite feminine in appearance and manner, but the underlying suggestion that he was actually quite masculine drew both men and women to him. A potent variation on this theme is the blending of physical heat and emotional coldness. Dandies like Beau Brummel and Andy Warhol combine striking physical appearances with a kind of coldness of manner, a distance from everything and everyone. They are both enticing and elusive, and people spend lifetimes chasing after such men, trying to shatter their unattainability. The power of apparently unattainable people is devilishly seductive. We want to be the one to break them down. They also wrap themselves in ambiguity and mystery, either talking very little or talking only of surface matters, hinting at a depth of character you can never reach. When Marlene Dietrich entered a room or arrived at a party, all eyes inevitably turned to her. First, there were her startling clothes, chosen to make heads turn. Then there was her air of nonchalant indifference. Men and women, too, became obsessed with her, thinking of her long after other memories of the evening had faded. Remember, that first impression, that entrance, is critical. To show too much desire for attention is to signal insecurity and will often drive people away. Play it too cold and disinterested, on the other hand, and no one will bother coming near. The trick is to combine the two attitudes at the same moment. It is the essence of coquetry. Perhaps you have a reputation for a particular quality, which immediately comes to mind when people see you. You will better hold their attention by suggesting that behind this reputation, some other quality lies lurking. No one had a darker, more sinful reputation than Lord Byron. What drove women wild was that behind his somewhat cold and disdainful exterior, they could sense that he was actually quite romantic, even spiritual. Byron played this up with his melancholic airs and occasional kind deed. Transfixed and confused, many women thought that they could be the one to lead him back to goodness, to make him a faithful lover. Once a woman entertained such a thought, she was completely under his spell. It is not difficult to create such a seductive effect. Should you be known as eminently rational, say, hint at something irrational. Johannes, the narrator in Kierkegaard's The Seducer's Diary, first treats the young Cordelia with businesslike politeness, as his reputation would lead her to expect. Yet she very soon overhears him making remarks that hint at a wild, poetic streak in his character, and she is excited and intrigued. These principles have applications far beyond sexual seduction. To hold the attention of a broad public, to seduce them into thinking about you, you need to mix your signals. Display too much of one quality, even if it is a noble one, like knowledge or efficiency, and people will feel that you lack humanity. We are all complex and ambiguous, full of contradictory impulses. If you show only one side, even if it is your good side, you will wear on people's nerves. They will suspect you are a hypocrite. Mahatma Gandhi, a saintly figure, openly confessed to feelings of anger and vengefulness. John F. Kennedy, the most seductive American public figure of modern times, was a walking paradox, an East Coast aristocrat with a love of the common man, an obviously masculine man, a war hero, with a vulnerability you could sense underneath, an intellectual who loved popular culture. People were drawn to Kennedy like the steel filings in Wilde's fable. A bright surface may have a decorative charm, but what draws your eye into a painting is a depth of field, an inexpressible ambiguity, a surreal complexity. Reversal. The complexity you signal to other people will only affect them properly if they have the capacity to enjoy a mystery. Some people like things simple and lack the patience to pursue a person who confuses them. They prefer to be dazzled and overwhelmed. The great Belle Époque courtesan known as La Belle Otero would work a complex magic on artists and political figures who fell for her. But in dealing with the more uncomplicated, sensual male, she would astound them with spectacle and beauty. When meeting a woman for the first time, Casanova might dress in the most fantastic outfit, with jewels and brilliant colors to dazzle the eye. He would use the target's reaction to gauge whether or not she would demand a more complicated seduction. Some of his victims, particularly young girls, needed no more than the glittering and spellbinding appearance, which was really what they wanted, and the seduction would stay on that level. Everything depends on your target. Do not bother creating depth for people who are insensitive to it, or who may even be put off or disturbed by it. You can recognize such types by their preference for the simpler pleasures in life, their lack of patience for a more nuanced story. With them, keep it simple.